But it's great to be back in New York City, and a real privilege to be here at the CUNY Grad Center. So as Joyce mentioned, my first book is about Cambodian refugees here in the Bronx. And show of hands, who here prior to today or seeing the promo for this book talk even knew that there was a Cambodian refugee population in the Bronx? Okay. And there's a reason for that, and the reason for that is quite frankly that unlike other new immigrant groups in New York City, the Cambodian refugee community of the Bronx does not signify as an ethnic community. It is not an ethnic enclave in the way that Chinatown, Koreatown, and other Asian immigrant communities clearly are. There are no clear markers. It isn't ethnically capitalized. And so what you have is a community that lives between and among African Americans and Puerto Ricans primarily, within this space which we'll talk about, that Louis Bourquant describes as the hyperghetto. And the question I pose in my work is, how and why are Cambodian refugees and other Southeast Asian refugees the lone new immigrant event to the hyperghetto? In other words, as other immigrant groups resettle to other ethnic enclaves throughout the city, and don't get me wrong, many of them were, you know, impoverished or working poor, how is it and why is it that refugees from the wars in Southeast Asia were the lone new immigrant event to these places that were said to be void of capital, right? Places that were supposed to be left for dead after the urban unrest of the late 1960s. And that's really the question I'm going to pursue in this afternoon's talk. In addition to that, or running parallel to that, is a concern that I have and that many of us have about the state of refugee resettlement today. So if you know anything about refugee resettlement, you know that for the most part, for the past 30-plus years, it's enjoyed, if we can call it that, bipartisan support. It hasn't been a flashpoint issue or an issue that's divided the liberals and conservatives. In fact, it's one of the few issues that, you know, both sides of the aisle have routinely come together around because each got something out of the refugee. And all of that changed rather abruptly in November of 2015. Like, if we could mark a definitive moment in which refugee resettlement policy became a polarizing issue, it really had to be right after the terrorist attacks in Paris, the shootings in Paris. Immediately following that, you see U.S. politicians, especially those running for the Republican ticket, begin to question our refugee resettlement policy in the U.S. And you could even hear, if you were kind of paying attention, the collective kind of sigh or gasp on the part of refugee resettlement workers who said, okay, this ride is over, and we're finally going to be scrutinized in ways that we haven't been before, and that's exactly what happened. So as of fall 2015, we, for the first time, I would say, since the passage of the Refugee Resettlement Act of 1980, have been divided, radically divided, over the question of refugee resettlement. So where I'm going to begin is during the late 1970s, right before the passage of the Refugee Resettlement Act, the Refugee Act of 1980, at a point in which, again, both liberals and conservatives were in general consensus that refugee resettlement to the U.S. was a good thing. And I'm going to begin with an ad from, I'm supposed to put this slide up. I'm told by my students that I should put this slide up before every talk, and that other people will know what to do with it, even if I don't. So there you are. I'll give it another 3 seconds. Okay. So here is an excerpt from an advertisement taken out in the New York Times. We call upon President Carter and the U.S. Congress to facilitate the entrance of these refugees into the U.S. If our government lacks compassion for these dispossessed human beings, it is difficult to believe that the same government can have much compassion for America's black minority or for America's poor. Signed, Black Americans Urge Admission of Indochinese Refugees. And it was a full-page ad taken out in the New York Times on the 19th of March, 1978. So I'm going to move from this excerpt to a quote, to quoting a housing organizer from the Bronx, who during the early 1980s was among the first Bronx residents to greet the Cambodian refugees who resettled to the Northwest Bronx. Her name is Blanca Ramirez. Quote, "When we first went to visit the refugee families on 193rd Street, the conditions were horrible," Blanca Ramirez recalled. "There was no heat, no hot water, the windows were broken. It was freezing, and you could see your breath in the air. It was like nothing I had ever seen before," end quote. It was 1985, and Ramirez was a housing organizer with the Northwest Bronx Community and Clergy Coalition, a group at the forefront of organizing Bronx tenants who were victims of various housing abuses, ranging from habitability violations to bank redlining. She was among the first residents to reach out to the Cambodian refugees who were moving into apartments in the area. And as it happened, Ramirez had been monitoring the buildings they were moving into for over a year. According to Ramirez, these properties were, quote, on the trouble list. Local organizers, as well as officials with the city's Housing Preservation and Development Unit, considered these buildings to be among the most derelict properties in the neighborhood. Quote, "Who would be crazy enough to move into one of those buildings?" Ramirez asked the colleague who had brought her news of these new arrivals. "I'm not sure," the colleague replied. "Something about refugees from Thailand," end quote. Ramirez goes on, "I remember the first refugee apartment I visited. They had nothing, an entire family sharing mats in the middle of the living room floor. That was all the furniture they had. The rest of their belongings, clothes, some supplies, were neatly stacked against the wall. The first question that came to my mind was, okay, you're from a war, but why come here? And that's when I realized that they had actually been placed here by an agency. I mean, here we are, blacks and Latinos, just trying to survive this crazy situation, and somebody thought to place the refugees here? I recall an African-American tenant saying to me, hey, that building was once abandoned. Now they've got Chinese people from a war living in there. What the hell's going on? Look, if they could put people from a war in here, then this world is a bad, bad place." So the longstanding residents of the Bronx felt compassion for the refugees, even as some of them mistook the latter's nationality. But they were no less bewildered by the presence of these newcomers. They could hardly divine what forces had led them from the war zone to this particular section of the Bronx teetering on collapse. Certainly the resettlement of refugees to these neighborhoods and units was not what the coalition of black leaders, among them Jesse Jackson, Julian Bond, and Roy Wilkins, had in mind when in 1978 they took out this full-page ad in the Times, urging President Carter to resettle thousands of refugees who were languishing in makeshift border camps throughout Southeast Asia. These civil rights stalwarts framed the resettlement of refugees as a matter of racial justice, one that was tied to the goals of the ongoing black freedom struggle. And I'm going to read more fully from this ad, which there's an image of it. It reads, "Our struggle for economic and political freedom is inextricably linked to the struggle of Indochinese refugees who also seek freedom. If our government lacks compassion for these dispossessed human beings, it is difficult to believe that the same government can have compassion for America's black minority or for America's poor," end quote. So by asserting this inextricable link between the black freedom struggle and the freedom sought by refugees, the ad suggests that refugee resettlement to the U.S. is a referendum on whether or not the Civil Rights Project will extend into the 1980s and beyond. The ad invokes the expansive vision of civil rights, reminding the public that the movement was, at its best, internationalist and class conscious. It also calls upon the United States to be compassionate, something it must certainly demonstrate following the brutalities of the Vietnam War. Compassion for refugees, the ad reasons, will no doubt redound to the black community as it continues to struggle against racism and poverty. Now, Carter would eventually sign into law the Refugee Act, just as the civil rights leaders implored of him. But the signatories to this full-page ad did not anticipate that the refugees were going to be resettled into neighborhoods where compassion was a vanishing proposition, especially for its longstanding black and Latino residents. By the late 1970s, these neighborhoods into which refugees were being resettled had already become what Waquant terms hyperghettos. These are urban spaces that are post-insurrectionary. They come after the urban unrest of 1967 and 68. They're places that were devastated by divestment and by the destruction wrought by the urban insurrection. And they became spaces in which to warehouse and punish the poorest of the urban poor, who were no longer seen as those who would produce, as productive members of the industrial economy. Rather, if they played a productive role, it was as those who would be stigmatized, constrained, and ostracized within the urban landscape. Now, many people who describe the hyperghetto as a site of liberal warfare, a site in which a low-intensity warfare takes shape, defined by the war on drugs, mass incarceration, and state punishment in general. And here I would borrow from my colleague Mimi Nguyen, who defines liberal warfare as, quote, war waged not only in the name of human rights and freedom, but violence that is vital to the genealogy of human freedom. And so it's the engagement in low-intensity warfare, right? The war on crime, mass incarceration, which enables liberal freedom, and hence we describe it as liberal warfare. Okay, so just to give you a sense of how many Cambodian refugees were resettled to these hyperghettos, I'm going to throw some statistics at you. Here's an image first of the Bronx during the late 1970s and early 80s. So approximately 1 million Southeast Asian refugees were resettled after the Refugee Resettlement Act of 1980. Among them were 150,000 Cambodians. And approximately 55% of these refugees were placed in, again, some of the poorest urban neighborhoods in the U.S., what I'm describing here as hyperghettos. Now, around 10,000 of them arrived to the Bronx during the 1980s. But by the mid-1990s, their numbers level off at about 4,000. And this is because this living situation was just untenable for so many. And the 6,000 or so who left didn't necessarily move up. They just moved out, like laterally, to other hyperghettos that were a bit more manageable for them than the Bronx. But if you look at 1990 census statistics on the Cambodian population in the Bronx, you have about 43% living in poverty, 24% unemployed, 62% without a high school education, and 80% welfare participation rate. That last statistic actually isn't census. It's a survey that we did in the Bronx as community organizers. And when we went door to door, we found that about 80% of the people we surveyed were receiving some form of public assistance. And this was after the passage of the 1996 Welfare Reform Act, when so many people were thrown off of welfare. We still had a very high welfare participation rate. Okay. So how do we understand Cambodian presence in the hyperghetto and statistics which rival that of, you know, any other race or ethnic group when it comes to unemployment and poverty? And these statistics are routinely higher than they are for African Americans and Latinos who live in the same area. In fact, Southeast Asian refugees, particularly Cambodians and Laotians, have the highest per capita welfare and unemployment rates and poverty rates of any race or ethnic group in the U.S., save for those who are living on Native American reservations. Okay, how do we understand this phenomenon? And here I'm going to turn to the work of Aiwa Ong, anthropologist at UC Berkeley, who in her book, Buddha is Hiding, argues that the model minority myth is obviously completely irrelevant as it relates to Southeast Asian refugees. She notes how Cambodian and Laotians by the 1990s have been removed from the model minority category, separated from, quote, ethnic Chinese immigrants from Hong Kong, Taiwan, and China, along with Vietnamese immigrants as well. Right, so the Vietnamese get into the model minority category, but the Cambodians and Laotians are cast out, given these statistics. But having been cast out of the model minority, the question becomes, how are these Southeast Asian refugees now going to be figured by hegemonic races? That is, what was their new racial location going to be if they're not model minorities? And in Ong's assessment, Cambodians were racialized as a new, quote-unquote, underclass. Right, the pejorative, sociological pejorative used to describe intractable black poverty, the behavioral, so-called behavioral causes behind that poverty. Specifically, she claims that they are subjected to a, quote, ideological blackening, in contrast to the whitening experienced by Vietnamese and ethnic Chinese immigrants. However, the terms of this blackening are a bit unclear in Ong's rendering. On the one hand, she equates blackening with a range of low-wage laborers mired in working poverty because they have few skills to match the primary labor market, and these include Ethiopians, Afghans, and other Central Americans. On the other hand, she uses blackening to refer to the way in which Cambodians are associated with poor African Americans, with high unemployment, welfare dependency, teenage pregnancy rates, because of their, quote, location and isolation in inner-city neighborhoods, end quote. So here she's actually conflating two very distinct racial formations in her invocation of blackening. But these conceptual dilemmas notwithstanding, Ong's analysis leads me to question how a blackening of any sort, this making of a new underclass out of refugees, was even possible under the terms of liberal warfare in the hyperghetto. In other words, was she saying that refugees had suddenly become the enemies of liberalism in the same way that African Americans and, to an extent, Puerto Ricans had? Were they now being targeted for dispersal, divestment, planned shrinkage, and other war tactics? Allow me to return to Mimi Nguyen's definition of liberal warfare as that which is that violence which claims to be, quote, incidental to its exercise of power to free others from a named enemy who is in their midst, end quote. Here I argue that in the Northwest Bronx and in other hyperghettos of the early 1980s, African-American tenants were targeted as the primary enemies of liberalism, to be dispersed by planned shrinkage, punished for staying behind in these hollowed-out ghettos, whereas Southeast Asians were inserted into these sites of liberal warfare as those who should be rescued from it, as those deserving of freedom. To grant liberal warfare's continuance, however, this rescue of the refugee could never be truly realized. Instead, the refugee was continuously positioned as collateral damage, those incidentally injured in the war to rescue them. Specifically, they were held in derelict housing conditions so that they could be targeted for a rescue that could never actually take place, a fictive rescue that justified liberal warfare's continuance. These and other forms of ongoing urban captivity rendered talk of a model minority irrelevant, but this didn't mean that Southeast Asian refugees were subjected to the same forms of vilification and ridicule that were directed at the putative underclass. Okay? So they're not, on the one hand, underclass, they're not, on the other hand, model minority, but yet they play a role within this site. I argue that Cambodian refugees were subject to a set of alternative practices that I term refugee exceptionalism. The ideologies and discursive practices that figure refugees as necessarily in the hyperghetto, but never of it. It's the process whereby refugees are resettled into and then recurrently saved from the hyperghetto and its attendant modalities of captivity. Uninhabitable housing stock, permanent exclusion from the labor market, and punitive social policy. However, refugee exceptionalism never actually removes the refugees from hyperghetto spaces and institutions, certainly not in any material sense. On the contrary, it requires that she be held in perpetual captivity so that she can be used over and over again. Now, the goals of refugee exceptionalism are twofold. First, it masks the systemic inequalities and violences of a refugee resettlement program that, as an extension of U.S. colonial and imperial projects in Southeast Asia, proclaimed Cambodians and other Southeast Asian refugees to be beneficiaries of American liberal freedoms that the U.S. could not successfully deliver through its acts of warfare. Because, as you know, the U.S. lost the war. I kind of have to throw that in because people will sometimes stop me and say, well, why couldn't it? And I'm like, it was the war that we lost. Anyway, by casting refugees as subsisting in an unending state of arrival at liberalism, those whose struggles with poverty in the urban U.S. are deemed perpetually temporary and adaptive, refugee exceptionalism preserves and extends the narrative of Southeast Asian subjects' salvation through U.S. intervention. So there's a rescue project that attends to the idea of refugee exceptionalism. The second goal, though, is by insisting that refugees be saved from the grips of the underclass, it reinforces the terms that produce African Americans as the undeserving poor, these domestic minorities for whom the underclass concept was originally formulated. In other words, refugee exceptionalism preserves and extends the justification of punishment of certain populations in the hyperghetto. Now, taking those two goals together, we might say that Cambodian refugee presence in the hyperghetto, mediated through refugee exceptionalism, represents the convergence of two distinct yet relational genealogies of white supremacist governance, colonialism and slavery. Ra's presence here elucidates the hyperghetto as slavery's afterlife. In turn, the hyperghetto as anti-blackness reveals the contours of an unfinished colonialism. So how did this play out on the ground, as it were? How did refugee exceptionalism take shape day to day? And this is what my book tries to explore by looking at key hyperghetto sites: housing, the welfare state, the home working economy, and the criminal justice system as it relates to poor women in particular. And in the book, I begin with the housing displacements that the protagonist in my book, Ra Prahn, experiences in her first few years after being resettled, and then, again, pretty much for the next three decades. But in the first few years, she's displaced about four times. And we did a count of all the houses that she's lived in since arriving to the Bronx, and what we found is that her longest stay was less than her stay in the refugee camp in Thailand. So if you took all the houses, all the housing that she lived in between 1986 when she was resettled and 2012 when we finished our interviews, the refugee camp in Thailand represents her longest stay in one place. The camp is slightly more stable than the ghetto, was the empirical argument from that, or the quantitative, quantitatively empirical argument from that study. And what was interesting was that the social workers who placed her in uninhabitable housing stock and then moved her to the next uninhabitable housing stock failed with each turn to bring her, to deliver to her a home that had less violence, and just merely relocated her from one vacant apartment to the next in the same troubled area. And with each placement, they seemed only to renew Ra's captivity in the liberal warfare that was the hyperghetto. And yet those handling her engaged in refugee exceptionalism, telling her that her situation was only temporary, that the hardships of the Northwest Bronx was only one stop along the way to something better, even though there was clearly no evidence of that, right? This was the narrative she kept getting. And to be sure, many Cambodians did leave the Bronx, as I mentioned at the outset, but most of them did not find improved situations. Again, they only moved laterally to other hyperghettos throughout the Northeast, Philadelphia, Providence, Lowell, Danbury, Connecticut, Hartford. You know, so this is where they went. Many of those who stayed in the Bronx continued to live in the same derelict apartments in which they were originally resettled, and those like Ross simply moved from one substandard unit to the next within the same square 2 miles. So all told, the Cambodians of the Northwest Bronx experienced no economic mobility, even as the resettlement agencies, landlords, and other keepers of the hyperghetto over 3 decades consistently hailed them as perpetual newcomers on the verge of something else, as those only passing through. Now, during the 1990s, the late 1990s, when I began working as a community organizer in the Northwest Bronx, I advocated for refugee families in the very same buildings that Ramirez had attempted to organize over a decade earlier. I helped Cambodian tenants file complaints against building owners who were guilty of a number of habitability violations. The landlords accused me of being an interloper, an agitator, and they were right. But echoing what happened to Ramirez years earlier, these social workers who were in those very same buildings working with the Cambodian refugees consistently referred to Cambodian refugees as the new tenants. Those who, unlike longer established Black and Latino tenants, had never given the landlord any trouble until now. They seemed unable to fathom that the Cambodian tenants had actually been living in their buildings for over 15 years. And yet they didn't cast these Cambodian refugees as model minority strivers. The landlords and the social workers knew full well that the Cambodians were not economically mobile. If they preferred Cambodians over Blacks and Puerto Ricans, it was because the newcomers were impoverished third world subjects who made slum buildings solvent again. They paid the rent, and they rarely complained about the poor housing conditions they endured. And this made them valuable not as model minorities, but as continuous captives who did not transgress to hyperghetto status. In keeping with the terms of refugee exceptionalism, the Cambodian refugee constantly renewed their status as those who were only in but never of the hyperghetto. So the consistency with which the numerous Asians practiced refugee exceptionalism points to its vast discursive power. Okay? And it wasn't just limited, this power, to the conscious actions of agents that attempted to meet certain political or economic ends. Rather, other social workers who were more sympathetic to the political goals of us community organizers, as well as social scientists, right, and grant makers, were also, in their own ways, reinforcing this implicit body of knowledge known as refugee exceptionalism. As an organizer, I noticed how refugee exceptionalism as subject-producing discourse was carried out in philanthropy. Foundations that supported our work insisted all the time, when I used to go to meetings and talk about our grants, that the poverty, joblessness, and poor health of Southeast Asian refugees was a matter of immigrant adaptation. Immigrant adaptation. In this way, they insisted on decoupling these violences from the broader war being waged against all inhabitants of the hyperghetto. Refugee exceptionalism also came across in my conversations with local school teachers, who attributed the struggles of Cambodian refugee students to their newcomer status, even though many of these students had actually been born in the Bronx. The suggestion was that Cambodian students' poor grades and high dropout rates had little to do with the general assault on inner-city public education. The discourse of refugee exceptionalism was particularly pronounced in the mainstream media's coverage of the Bronx Cambodian community. Since the 1980s, the New York Times has been one of the few major papers to periodically cover the borough's small Cambodian enclave. A cursory review of some of its articles from 1994 to 2012 reveals a consistent representation of the Cambodian residents as perpetual newcomers to the hyperghetto. So in 1994, they ran an article in which they quote Sister Jean Marshall of the St. Rita's Refugee Center, who gives an assessment of how long it takes a refugee to finally be settled. And she offers that it takes them between 10 and 15 years to go from refugee to non-refugee status. And she attributes this to a number of different economic, cultural, and social obstacles that must be overcome. So by 1994, when this article was published, the earliest refugee arrivals had either already transitioned to non-refugee status, or they were on the cusp of doing so. And yet, 6 years later, in 2000, you have another Times article that suggests that the refugees are nowhere near shedding their refugee past. In an article titled Children of the Killing Fields, Cambodian teenagers are quoted and or are studied, and the article makes the following observation about them. These young people also face a host of distinctive problems, and few community groups exist to help out these new arrivals, end quote. But it had been 18 years since the first wave of Cambodians had been resettled to the area. And most of the teenagers interviewed had either been born or raised in the Bronx. And I know this because I actually sourced the article for the journalist. And yet, still, that's the conclusion that he drew. Even as late as 2012, 30 years after the arrival of the first wave of Cambodians to the Bronx, another Times piece comments on how refugees are, quote, still struggling to strike a balance between adopting American customs and holding fast to values at home. Again, this is 30 years after their arrival. And to be honest, at this point, the Cambodian refugees are the longest standing tenants in these buildings by far. Mm-hmm. So in these Times articles, the refugees are frozen in time. Over three decades, they are continually in a state of arrival. They are not allowed to be anything other than the hyperghettos, recurring newcomers. And yet these articles refrain from casting them as model minority paragons of liberalism. Instead, they appear as captives who must be repeatedly saved from these named enemies of liberalism, the post-insurrectionary underclass, their neighbors. Here, once again, the Cambodian refugees are enlisted as collateral damage in liberal warfare. So the challenge moving forward for both relational ethnic studies and critical refugee studies is to understand how these rescues and removals, this refusal to recognize refugee settledness, stages different forms of racism, particularly anti-blackness. For the Cambodian refugee is suspended in a perpetual state of arrival, or to suspend them in a perpetual state of arrival is to disassociate refugee poverty from the so-called true inhabitants of the hyperghetto. Casting this dynamic in terms of liberal warfare, we might say that refugee exceptionalism insists on the unending rescue of Cambodian refugees from urban abjection as a way to justify unending warfare against an undeserving and definitively black urban population. Okay, so by way of conclusion, the obligatory question posed by the scholar activist, what is to be done, right? What political opportunities exist to challenge the damaging and divisive effects of refugee exceptionalism? What alternative futures might we imagine and enact? And to this, the obligatory scholar activist response to his own question, activism, right? And here I want to share a slide, before that, here's one of the first images taken of a Cambodian refugee family in the Bronx. It was taken by Mel Rosenthal, who was like the consummate Bronx chronicler, right? And he had no intention of photographing Cambodian refugees. He was going door to door giving information about lead paint poisoning. And he says, wow, you know, I stumbled upon this family. And there were refugees from, you know, Thailand. I realized they're originally from Cambodia. I had no idea they were in the Bronx. And he snaps this photo. And that's pretty much how people kind of found out that there was a Cambodian population in the Bronx. They literally stumbled upon them at times. And here's an image of Ra Pran, who's the subject of my book. And this is her photo taken during her time in the Thai camps. But I want to direct our attention to this photo taken in 1998. And it was taken outside of a health clinic, the Montefiore Family Health Center on 193rd Street, right across the street from this building where the initial Cambodian families were resettled. And this clinic was being protested by the community because it made the unfortunate decision or proposal to cut translation services for Cambodian refugee patients at the mental health clinic. And if you cut off interpretation services, you pretty much are cutting off services. So they launched this this protest outside, or relaunched this protest outside, and eventually what happened was this group of people that was protesting outside moved inside and did an impromptu sit-in at the welfare center. But I want to direct your attention to the woman in the middle, who we will just call Grandma for now, with the placard "Stop Discrimination." Okay, this is 1998. Well, I live in Austin now, but every summer I get back to the Bronx, and last summer I was there, and lo and behold, Montefiore decides again that it's going to try to cut interpretation services. So another protest is organized, now almost 20 years later, and we're now outside of Montefiore headquarters on Fordham Road. And I snap a photo. And there's Grandma. She's sitting now. We'll give her that, right? It's been a while. But there she is again, and I'm being completely honest with you when I say that I did not do this with any intention at all. It wasn't until I got home that I realized that this photo looked strikingly similar to another one I had in my collection. But there she is, right? And it speaks to a kind of resilience, right, that attends to their day-to-day lives and how they survive the situation going from the war zone to the camps to these hyper-ghettos. But also a resilience and a persistence that also attends to their activism as well. Okay, so this protest is organized by a group known as Mekong NYC that is doing fantastic work with Cambodian population up in the Bronx. And they remind me that there are indeed activists and organizers on the ground engaging in and building a political alternative. Because I often get asked, well, what is the fate of these Cambodian refugees, right? How do we understand their fate? And their fate, I have to say, is inextricably linked to the fate of African Americans and Latinos in those very same neighborhoods. It's not as if a refugee movement or an Asian American movement, independent of what's happening with blacks and Latinos, could take shape to produce better results for the refugees. And so this politics, this political alternative, needs to begin by demonstrating through grassroots-led research, advocacy, and direct action that Cambodians have never been, as refugee exceptionalism claims, merely visitors to the hyperghetto. That their entrenched poverty over three decades in the hyperghetto is evidence of a continued captivity. It's a politics that links past and present, recognizing that the forces of liberal empire and war that drove their families out of Cambodia are inscribed in the liberal war carried out in the Bronx and other hyperghettos. To illustrate this point, allow me to invoke Chaya Chow, a young organizer who is the director of Mekong, and who I also feature in the book. In explaining the Cambodian presence in the hyperghetto, Chaya asserts that the Bronx Cambodians have, quote, never left the camps, unquote. In other words, the resettlement to the hyperghetto was neither historically incidental nor sociologically temporary. It was rather a continuation of their past conditions of captivity. Now, how might this knowledge serve as the condition of possibility for lasting alliances among Cambodians, African Americans, Puerto Ricans, and others held captive in the hyperghetto? How might it enable forms of collective resistance? Organizations like Mekong NYC, which Chaya co-founded, are building such alliances. Mekong is rooted in the Cambodian community, but it is also the nucleus of a coalition, a multiracial coalition, of Northwest Bronx groups that are working to address issues such as skyrocketing rents, cuts in funding to community health centers, and the privatization of public space. according to Chaya, it represents a new generation of Southeast Asian groups throughout the country that have made multiracial organizing a strategic priority. Similarly, in Rhode Island, there's a group known as the Providence Youth and Student Movement, which is rooted, again, also in the Cambodian refugee community, but is the linchpin of the city's multiracial youth organizing. Its core values, one of its core values is, quote, ghetto roots, which PRISM states in its mission statement, or defines in its mission statement, as organizing on the streets, in homes, and in the hearts of communities, affirming solidarity with the most oppressed and most in need, end quote. And PRISM was involved in a recent campaign to pass new legislation to stop racial profiling throughout the state of Rhode Island, which of course serves the interests of all youth of color in that state. Another group, Freedom Inc. in Madison, Wisconsin, works with both Hmong and African American youth to address a range of economic, health, and educational inequalities afflicting both communities. It emphasizes the need to challenge patriarchy and heteronormativity in its work through projects that support queer and gender nonconforming Hmong and African American high school students. Freedom Inc.'s slogan is, "Our community is our campaign," which underscores the organization's belief that winning specific policy demands must go hand in hand with addressing the community's need to heal from traumas past and present. Now, these groups represent the next phase of refugee movements in the hyperghetto. They prove that resistance is indeed taking shape among the children of refugees, articulated by and through members of other oppressed groups. At the same time, these forms of activism are rooted in the particular histories and conditions of Southeast Asian refugees as they draw on and extend the resiliency of the first generation that was resettled to the hyperghetto. The younger generation keeps the first generation close at hand to remind them that matters of justice remain unsettled, that redemption is elusive. Thank you.
Any questions, comments?
Yeah, I have a question. Yeah. In terms of the clinics, where you said that there is no translation services, Cambodians have to come maintain speaking Khmer. Mm-hmm. I guess that's wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, many of them came over as older adults, you know, like in their 30s and 40s. So, you know, very few of them were able to acquire English proficiency, even if they spent upwards of 5 years in the camp.
But their children.
And the children speak English primarily. They do the older ones who like came as, you know, preteens. They will retain the Khmer. Those who were like babies born in the camps, you know, as.
So is that a bilingual household in terms of both languages?
It is a bilingual, no, it's not a bilingual household, no. The parents are not bilingual, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah. Yeah. So the children are only speaking English, but the elders are speaking Khmer.
In many cases, and that's in fact why the work, and I didn't get into this in the talk, but I write about it in the book. Our organization made a strategic decision to work with the young people in that neighborhood because there's a huge gap between them and their parents culturally, generationally. Many of their parents had lost older children during the war and the genocide, and they recreated families in the camps. So you had this huge gap, both again, in terms of like the age ranges between the parents and the age difference between the parents and the children, but also culturally, many of the children couldn't even communicate with their parents.
Dr. Tang, you know, you made a difference between the Vietnamese refugees and the Cambodians, and then my experience has mainly been with the working with attending many activities of Vietnamese refugees in Orange County, you know, in California. And, you know, they seem some of them are Vietnamese, some of them are Chinese Vietnamese, but they seem fairly well organized. And at the particular Buddhist temple I went to, it would start because all of the people had met originally in the camp in Thailand.
Right.
And so they sort of gradually found each other and then formed a network and so forth. And, you know, it seems like, I think you had said that the Vietnamese were considered the sort of the more the model minority, and then the Cambodians as Nazis. Can you kind of like
talk a little bit about that? Yeah, it's a complicated situation that, it's a heterogeneous situation, as it is with many ethnic communities. And I think what happens is we tend to lump Southeast Asian refugees together, and to say nothing of the way we lump Asian Americans together. But the Vietnamese in Orange County, many of them actually did not spend time in refugee camps. Many of them were, at least the initial refugees who resettled to the area, were evacuated from South Vietnam immediately after the so-called Fall of Saigon. And they were brought to, you know, Camp Pendleton or, you know, other U.S. bases, and then quickly transitioned and resettled into Southern California. And many of them maintained some of their, you know, were able to bring over some of their capital, their wealth and resources, and establish Orange County as an ethnic enclave, much like Chinatown or Koreatown. You did have, after the 1980s, though, a wave of Southeast Asian refugees from Vietnam who were not of those privileged classes and mostly of the peasantry, right? Or they were just laborers. And they tend to demonstrate statistics that are similar to that of Cambodians and Laotians. They tend to have higher welfare, you know, rates and higher unemployment rates. And so there's more economic heterogeneity within the Vietnamese American community than there is among Cambodian Americans who do not come over as a first wave in mass in the same way that many of the Vietnamese did. And so you don't see a kind of equivalent when it comes to Cambodians, equivalent to Orange County. Instead, the majority of Cambodians tend to live in these much smaller enclaves in cities like that are medium-sized and throughout the entire U.S. And so I argue in this book, and I stand by it, that there are few new immigrant groups post-1965 that are as economically homogeneous as Cambodian and Laotian refugees.
Actually, I became aware, in response to your question, of the Cambodian community in the Bronx, actually, as a graduate student when I was in the early 1980s. I got one of those survival gigs you get as a graduate student doing evaluations of ESL and bilingual programs for the Board of Education, which, you know, had to be filed to Washington, even though no one ever read them. I got the assignment of doing a Central Bronx Vietnamese program that was in a number of different high schools. And, of course, one of the interesting things when you actually went to the Vietnamese program and talked to the people teaching the Vietnamese program and the kids is you discovered that about half the Vietnamese in the program were, in fact, Cambodians.
Yep.
And this had sort of, they just got lumped in there, you know. So the idea of running a bilingual program was an absurdity because... So, essentially, they were doing ESL because what else could you do when you had, like, four different languages in the group? But one of the things that was striking is that even then, and these were poorer Vietnamese, this was later arrivals, mid-80s people, they were already being framed much more as the model minority than the Cambodians. So I remember a principal of a big high school in the Bronx telling me, when I asked him what was the impact of having the Asian students in the school, said, well, you know, being a minority themselves, they show the black and Latino kids that you really can make it if you try.
Right.
That was literally in those words. I mean, so that was literally the way they were being framed. But it was already the Vietnamese were being framed that way,
yeah,
even though they were just as poor, and they also were from peasant backgrounds. But the Cambodians were very much not. And they were being seen as the, okay, why are these Asians not like the other Asians thing? It was already going on in people's minds. Partially, it was kind of gendered in a way that, you know, it was the boys who were a problem. The girls are, you know, and it was so it was kind of almost like the girls will be like Asians, but the boys are going to be like Latinos. You know, it was the framing that the people were already getting to.
Yeah.
The other question I had, though, was most of the Cambodians who arrived in the Bronx during that period left. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right that they left for other places that were just as poor. In fact, in some cases, poor. But they left, by and large, for places that were less likely to be African-American settlements and that were in smaller cities. So they were hyper-ghettos in some sense, but they were not hyper-ghettos in the way the South Bronx was a hyper-ghetto. A lot of people end up in Lowell. A lot of people end up in cities in the upper Midwest. A lot of people end up in small New England cities, you know. And I'm wondering what that's about, because it's not quite that they're going from one high. It's not. Some people move laterally from a hyper ghetto in the Bronx to a hyper ghetto in Philadelphia, but that's not the dominant pattern. Is for them to seek out equally inexpensive, if also equally crappy, housing in places that are white, formerly white working class cities that had sort of fallen apart and deindustrialized.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that isn't a something different from either the model minority or the hyper-ghetto in some sense.
That is a fascinating question. I mean, as you're speaking, Phil, I want to do that study, actually. I don't know. You know, I think that from what I've seen, when they move to Providence, they are moving to neighborhoods that do have high concentrations of African Americans. There's a geographic question here because they're not high rises. They're not. There's not the same density.
Yeah.
So that's where my mind is kind of racing now. I'm wondering how you would even structure this.
But I mean, none of these. I mean, you know, the big Hmong concentrations in Wausau, Wisconsin. You know.
Right. Right. You're absolutely right. Well, the Hmong are actually kind of a slightly different story, given some of the way that they were recruited into certain industries. So I think you're absolutely right. There's a nuance there that when they move out of the Bronx, do they know enough about American racism to say, you know what, the next place we go, right, we're going where, you know, there are less concentrations of African Americans. But then how do you explain the fact that you have Cambodian refugees in Camden, New Jersey?
Yeah.
Why is anybody moving to Camden, New Jersey during the 80s and 90s? And yet you look at the census data and you're like, there are Cambodians here in this hood. And in Philadelphia, they were in the heart of the black community too. So I think, you know, it would be good to see whether or not these so-called secondary migrations did in fact, you know, from the Bronx, if the folks were moving from the hyper-ghetto to a semi-hyper-ghetto situation in another city. What we do know, though, is that they were not moving, and this is the other question that just puzzles me, they were not moving to ethnic enclaves.
Right.
So did the church play a role in this in some way, in terms of maybe relocating them based on neighborhoods where they had access to information about housing for lower-income and poor families?
Absolutely. So what happens is, you know, the State Department subcontracts volunteer agencies, the largest one being Catholic Charities, who in turn subcontract a whole bunch of groups. And the one in New York was known as the New York Association for New Americans. And they're essentially looking for the least expensive housing they could possibly find. And what they say is that we're trying to keep these refugees together, so we're going to look for buildings that have a lot of vacancies. Well, if you're a refugee resettlement agency worker and you find a building in the Bronx that has a lot of vacancies, do you not stop and ask yourself, why does this building have so many vacancies and why and so cheap, right, at such a cheap rent? And it's because, you know, other people don't want to live there. And what I write about in the book is that a lot of these buildings, as Blanca Ramirez intimates, there's a threat of arson. They were going to be torched by landlords who are trying to get out of these buildings and take the insurance. So, you know, Ramirez's take on these social workers and these agencies is that they were completely negligent. It was malpractice. They essentially placed these refugees in these units without ever taking a look at these units themselves or figuring out why there's so many vacancies in these places.
But might it not have been a deliberate effort to so-called repopulate people? I mean, for example, New York City has been known to direct populations into certain areas, even Flushing being one of them, when New York City Chinatown had, you know, experienced a huge demand in the 80s with the turnover of Hong Kong back to China. There is talk throughout the community of deliberate direction of new Chinese populations, Korean populations, to Flushing to relieve the pressure.
Yeah. You know, how intentional all this was, I can't say. What I can say, though, is that there was it was negligent. It was negligent. And if you think about the pressures that these resettlement agencies were under, no one's trying to throw them under the bus. You know, they were also confronted with a situation where it was like months and months of planning, anticipation, and then they were told these refugees are not coming. And then all of a sudden it was like, hurry up, they're all coming. And so they talk about being under duress. But still, don't you make the effort to at least go up and look at these units before you place people in them? And I think that was the big criticism that many of the local organizers had, that they just did not do the minimum that needed to be done. Yes?
Yeah. I was wondering, in the Bronx with the Cambodian communities, what their relationship with the police and the prison system are.
Yeah, that's a great question. So in this one chapter I have about the criminal justice system, what I argue and what I demonstrate is that the Cambodian youth were just as much at risk of being stopped and frisked, of being, victims of police brutality and misconduct as were their African-American and Latino neighbors. And this is because many of the Cambodian youth fell into sets, not really gangs, but sets that were black and Latino because they had to for survival. They weren't large enough in number to form their own. And I write about how the daughter of Ra one day gets picked up in a building drug sweep and she's brought to the precinct. She hasn't been charged with anything. She doesn't have a criminal record. And she's detained, and they bring out this gang book and her photos in it, and they ask her, well, why are you in this book? You know, who's this and who's that? And she's like, wait a minute, why am I in this gang book if I've never been arrested before? And so you get a sense that the Cambodian youth are not spared the day-to-day brutalities and reality of policing in the Bronx, even if refugee exceptionalism is the way in which they're handled in a broader discursive way. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Thank you for this presentation. I'm still struggling with the question: how did it actually happen that Cambodia ended up in the Bronx? And I'm thinking about how unique is it, how the situation is unique for New York City, and also how is it unique for the United States? Because recently there are many studies of poverty among refugees in the UK, for example, and one of the major reasons that is identified there as a factor contributing to their poverty is resettlement to exactly like the lowest income neighborhoods, which have all sorts of other problems already. What do you think about it?
Yeah, so a comparative refugee resettlement study should be done. That's off the top. I think we need that. It's long overdue. I think places like Sweden, Australia, completely different situation with respect to our refugee resettlement programs. What I argue is that the United States doesn't really have a refugee resettlement policy post resettlement. There really is no policy. It is all about getting them here, and then you have clauses in the Refugee Act of 1980 that say we demand that they don't become state dependents, and we demand that they find immediate employment. So our refugee policy amounts to this. Take people who have just survived the war zone and the camp, who are yet to heal from the physical and psychological damages of war, and get them to work immediately. Somehow we think that that's a good idea. Somehow we think that that's going to lead to a sustainable, future, that these people are going to somehow develop the social and, other forms of capital they need for long-term stability. What's been proven over the course of four decades now is that just the opposite happens. They never have the opportunity to heal and to rebuild their lives in a way that would allow them to advance. And even now, you see, and just as an aside, and I don't mean to digress, but did you catch how Starbucks made this claim that it was going to give X number of thousand jobs, 10,000 jobs to refugees, right? And then the right comes out and says, boycott Starbucks because they're not sufficiently anti-refugee. they're going to like give jobs to terrorists when mm-hmm. you know veterans don't have jobs. And what does this do? It crowds out the whole discussion about whether or not it's even smart to have refugees working for like you know Starbucks and these other ostensibly working poor jobs. As immediately after surviving the war zone, it doesn't make sense. And in other countries, that isn't the case. There is actually a resettlement policy post resettlement. So in the U.S., it was all a refugee resettlement policy. It's really foreign policy. It's about who we resettle and who we don't based on our geopolitical interests at that time. And once they get here, they're on their own, just don't become state dependents. But clearly that doesn't work because they do languish on welfare for decades. And then what do we do to resolve that? We introduce things like the Welfare Reform Act of 1996 and throw them off. So I think, you know, in the U.S., they get here as a matter of foreign policy, and once they're here, they're left to agencies that act negligently, place them wherever, and that usually is in the hyper-ghetto. Another way to say this is that these refugees are state-mediated migrants, right? Unlike migrants who come following the circuit of capital. As state-mediated migrants, they're going to move to sites of state mediation for the hyper-ghetto.
And not necessarily to sites of jobs.
And not that, yeah.
Which is what labor migrants always do.
Exactly. So if they don't follow the circuit of capital, they're not following the circuit of jobs. And the state says, okay, well, fine, you're here. Well, this is where our job is over. You figure it out yourself. And that usually defaults into going to sites where there are no jobs. And again, there are documented migrants. You know, they're probably the most heavily documented migrants you'll have in the U.S., and so they're completely eligible for all kinds of state programs, so long as these programs exist, which during the 80s and 90s, as we know, welfare and other forms of other social safety net programs face radical retrenchment. Yes?
You know, I wanted to follow up on two things you mentioned, which is the lack of policy on the resettlement and the geopolitical issue, because if you think of U.S. policy in Cambodia, this is almost like an ABC conclusion of the total incompetence, total contradictions,
the third act.
Reversal of policies in Cambodia. And I'm just thinking of, let me take the example that you said that many of these people, most of these people, were from peasant families, and they were results of the camps in Thailand, north of the Khmer Rouge. And if I were to contrast them, I'd probably raise, what, the 5% to 10% of Cambodian refugees who went with Luang Nal to Hawaii,
right.
who were welcomed in Hawaii. And this, again, is just complete, disgraceful example of, and I don't know how much the State Department people who refer these refugees are responsible. I'm just thinking that Cambodia was a much lower priority than Vietnam, deeper, you know. And I was going to ask you about the contrast, particularly with the Cambodians, with French policy,
French refugee policy, again, is different. They actually have a refugee resettlement policy post, post-resettlement, and many Cambodian refugees did elect to go to France. They had a smaller total number that they admitted, it being a smaller country. You know, the United States will often say that it's the most generous refugee resettlement country because it resettles the most number, but per capita it resettles very little compared to places like Sweden and France. But France did allow a good number of Cambodians to resettle. And again, there was a refugee policy of like adaptation, if you will, and integration, economic integration that far exceeded what we did here in the U.S. Yes.
Thanks very much for this talk. I worked for Montefiore at the Family Health Center on 193rd
Street.
And I do remember hiring a Cambodian to work as a translator.
Yeah.
But I wanted to, you talk about, so I have a question to ask you about what do these people think of who they are.
Yeah.
You talked a little bit about what other people think of them, but if you ask them, who do they say they are? Do they say they're Americans? Do they say they're Cambodians?
Yeah.
Do they say they're Asian Americans?
Yes.
Or are they Cambodian Americans? Because people have multiple identities. They have the identity of who they think they are and the identity of what other people think they are. I mean, I'm American-born, my parents are American-born, I still get asked, where am I from?
Great question. And can I just say, I love all the questions I'm getting today. It's like, these are like the best questions I've gotten in a long time, and I'm not just pandering to the camera. This is really terrific. Because you speak to the other concept that I developed in the book, in addition to refugee exceptionalism, and that is refugee temporality, the way in which the refugee understands her own time and place. And what I argue is that they don't see this break between here and there, past and present, the kind of transfigurative like moment of change upon arrival to the U.S. is pure fiction in the view of the refugee. And it comes as no surprise that they don't refer to themselves as Cambodian Americans. They don't refer to themselves as Asian Americans. They refer to themselves as Khmer, as Cambodian. And every now and then, you know, invoke being a refugee as kind of, you know, status. But I take their insistence on Khmer without the Khmer American and Asian American as an understanding that their condition in some ways is continuous, if not contiguous, from one territory to the next. The arbitrary way in which they're handled immediately upon being remanded into a refugee camp extends into the hyperghetto. And that is what I demonstrate through the book. Like, they see these agents, these so-called helping professions even, you know, the people who handle them, as people who have arbitrary power. They see the person who's able to cut off their welfare at any moment because a form wasn't handed in. And yet this family's now out of welfare for 3 months as acting as arbitrarily as those who handle her in the camps acted when they decided which family got rations and which did not. So how they see themselves is they don't buy into the fiction that we do, that the refugee designation means something. And I would argue that the Syrian refugee waiting to get into the United States right now doesn't invest in any notion that, you know, he or she is free upon coming to the U.S. And knows that this executive order that was signed last month is the clearest expression of how arbitrary power works. And what's so fascinating to me, I'm totally going off your question now, but I just need to say this, is that what the Trump administration has done is it demonstrated that it could, you know, it could engage in these art forms. Its arbitrary power is best played out against the most documented migrants, refugees, and the least, right, the undocumented immigrants. That's like a kind of low-hanging fruit that you could just use over and again to make the case for U.S. sovereignty, in this instance, cultural nationalism.
But do people become citizens? Do they register to vote? Do they send letters to their elected officials? I mean, when my grandparents came to the United States, they were not allowed to become citizens.
Yeah. They naturalized as for reasons of convenience, so that, you know, they're not vulnerable. But do they naturalize as a matter of civic participation? No.
Okay.
You were waiting.
Yes. I lost my train of thought,
okay.
But I'll regain it. And I more or less wanted to connect a couple questions that were asked before. And I'll ask this by framing it by saying what I do. So I'm a doctoral student here, and I study. And I've been, thank you for this presentation. It's been very fascinating to hear it. I study the political economy of immigration enforcement practices in this country, and I trace it to the arrival of Cuban Mayoritos and Haitians in 1980,
yeah.
After the signing of, 3 weeks after the signing of the Refugee Act of 1980. And I guess you were sort of touching upon this now when thinking of ways or how it is that the category of refugee, more than it expressing the experiences of people, though it does that in part, I guess, it really reflects the actions and the activity of the state and how the state is interacting with, in this case, people who are coming from the outside. And I'm wondering how you've tackled, or perhaps you do it in the book, with this idea or with this process of more than it being a self-identification or an identity that was created by a group of individuals. It's a category that's been imposed, and how my Cambodian immigrants have similarities with other immigrants who may also be, you know, refugees or fleeing devastation in their home countries, but also landing in what you call the hyper ghetto. And then I also wanted to see if you can expand more on the question that the gentleman asked around contact with the criminal legal system. And I was wondering, just because, I mean, over the last 15 years, even, I mean, I trace it back to 1980, but increasingly over the last 15 years, the machine for detention and deportation in this country has become a lot more sophisticated and systematic. So I'm wondering how it's affected the Cambodian community in particular.
So I'll begin with the last question. Up until 2002, Cambodians were not deportable because the U.S. did not have a repatriation agreement with
Which state you said?
2002. And then what happened was, because Cambodia and the U.S. did not have a repatriation agreement, Cambodians who had committed so-called aggravated felonies and were deportable, what happened was they languished in detention centers indefinitely, and they were known as lifers. Until one lifer from Seattle named Kim Ho Ma filed a lawsuit which went all the way to the Supreme Court, Ma versus Reno. It was adjudicated under Bush, George W. Bush. And the Supreme Court said, hey, indefinite detention is completely unconstitutional. This is not what was intended by the Immigration Act of 1996. So what did George Bush do? George Bush leaned on the Cambodian Interior to sign a memorandum of understanding that would be the workaround. So it forced the Cambodian state to say, you will take them. If you don't, you know, we'll deny visas to Cambodians who want to come to the U.S. There were also threats that the status of its application into the IMF would also be threatened if it didn't do this. And so based on that memorandum, the United States started to deport Cambodian refugees. But mind you, some of these young people who were deported had never actually lived in Cambodia. They were being deported to a country they never lived in because they were born where? In the Thai refugee camps. So imagine being deported to a place that you've never been to before, and a place that you hardly speak the language. This is what happened to several Cambodian young people, and most of them wound up in Phnom Penh, where they had to rebuild their lives, and they struggled. But what we essentially did is we deported if we were going to accept that they were at some point in their lives criminals, right? Then we reported people who were both the subjects of U.S. criminality and the products of U.S. criminality to Cambodia, under the pretense that they had come from Cambodia and they never had. And so what I'm arguing here is that what was created in the hyper-ghetto, right, gets kind of deported to Cambodia. And there's no other way to look at it, because there's no possible way you could argue that they had brought Cambodian crime to the U.S. and therefore we were deporting it back, right? And so the high number of Cambodian refugees who get caught up in the criminal justice system compared to Asian Americans is astounding to begin with, but then the fact that many of them being deported to countries that they've never lived in before is even more astounding. And in terms of, like, you know, the refugee category and what it means to people and, you know, conditions of solidarity and political identification, you know, I think that the refugee category, or this, like, displaced, you know, stateless category, means more to these refugees than does the Asian American identity or the Asian American racial formation. And this is something that I'm pretty confident about. And it goes to some of the things that we're talking about, Joyce, around what does Asian American activism even look like today. The Asian American Pan-Ethnic Coalition does, in my assessment, very little for refugees right now. I'm not trying to, you know, critique people for doing the work that they're doing in the Asian American movement, but it doesn't, it can't figure Southeast Asians as central to that project. And I think this is a frustration that many refugee activists feel. And if I can quote Chaya one more time, she said to me once, you know what? I love my Asian American brothers and sisters, right? But I just can't handle that right now. I just can't hold it all. And I thought about that, and I thought that was a statement of profound theoretical importance. I just can't hold it all. Because I'm putting out all these other fires, and I'm trying to make sense of our relationship to African Americans and Latinos and living in the hyper-ghetto. And the Asian American piece just seems like, you know, it doesn't do much for me right now. I'll join the coalition when it makes sense, but right now, these other identities about being a refugee in the hyper-ghetto, right, dealing with deportation, these are the things that form the nodes of my activism and my sense of solidarity.
I have too many questions, but I'll try and give you two quick ones. And one fast comment. The what you mentioned about second generation and later kids being deported back to Cambodia when they have no experience,
right.
That's exactly what's happening. And these may not be refugees of particularly the Central American North Triangle back to
right.
Al Jazeera's done programs on the impact in El Salvador, and I imagine Guatemala and Honduras are some of the one thing I wanted to know was that your concept of liberal warfare, mm-hmm. I sort of see three regimes of this as to what might be too liberal and one that's not. You have the failure of Keynesianism you talk about in your introduction, the Kerner Commission report, and that guy who worked for the Rand Commission writing the conclusion, and that's the only part that LBJ acts upon.
Right.
And that, of course, leads to everything from Nixon on forward.
Right.
So there's a failure of Keynesian liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can almost trace neoliberalism from then on, 1968 on. Now, you talk about this seminal change with after the Paris attacks, it's almost a year and a half ago.
Right.
Now it's not liberalism, it's fascism or neo-white nationalism.
Right.
Are you finding that's playing out any differently from the previous two, and is it a continuum, or is my classification too theoretical? One other quick question is, could you, if you know, you say again in the intro that the large exception within the exception, the large concentration is the 200,000 community in Long Beach, so the greater SoCal Los Angeles area. And this is a really simple marker, but you mention it again in your book that the Bronx community doesn't have, there isn't a restaurant here. There's a whole bunch in Boston. And then you look, because I've looked this before, there's a whole bunch in the Southern California area, for example.
Right.
How have they evolved? Is there a petty bourgeoisie, middle class, or something, or how is it?
So I'll take that last question. I don't believe that outside of Long Beach and Lowell, there are any significant Cambodian-American ethnic economies. You know, there you will have where, like, you have, like, vertically integrated kind of, like, industries, right, where, like, the restaurant industry can then kind of, you know, support restaurant supply industries and those who they employ. I don't believe that's happening anywhere outside of Long Beach and Lowell at all. When it comes to Cambodian Americans, I think the prevalence of Cambodian donut shops, which we all love, is not an example of an ethnic economy. It's rather, you know, a niche economy where Cambodian Americans got into it because they figured, you know, people still really like donuts,
yeah.
And you know, we're willing to work for less than, you know, the generation that came before. We're willing to work in these mom and pop shops. Okay. So that's my answer to that question. I don't think that what we're seeing there is like a Chinatown situation, but, you know, okay. And in terms of the three regimes, you know, I would say the predominant one is neoliberalism, that they come, you know, at the in the heart, at the heart of the neoliberal regime. You know, like they become, when as a neoliberal regime ascends, you see this refugee resettlement take shape. And you know, whether or not this third regime that we could describe as the fascist regime, the autocracy that we're experiencing now, is new for them, something new that they're going to confront. I'll say that neoliberalism has always had, you know, its repressive side, and this is where I think Waquan is absolutely right. We're too easily drawn into discussions about the soft side of neoliberalism, like the economic side of it, and not the ways in which it also firmed up the repressive state apparatus, right? And the marrying of the social welfare state with, you know, the police state. And I think the Cambodian refugees have been subject to that harder side of neoliberalism for the better part of their time here. And I don't know that, in that sense, some of the repressive things we're seeing right now are entirely new. Does that make sense?
Yeah.